Hello, friends. This is Paul Scharf, Church Ministries representative with the Friends of Israel Gospel Ministry. So glad to have you back with me today as we continue our online study into the coronavirus crisis. Just a quick reminder that you can contact me at pscharf@foi.org or check my page on the Friends of Israel website at foi.org/scharf. And, of course, you can access my content here through sermonaudio.com/pscharf. And I'm delighted to have you with me as part of our study today as we continue to look at prophetic lessons from the coronavirus crisis. Today we're going to enter into Lesson 2, and I'm going to divide Lesson 2 into some smaller, if you will, bite-sized lessons. And so this one will be Part A, and I think that that will be advantageous for a number of reasons, and hopefully more accessible to more listeners and viewers who can join us for just a shorter time. And if you're watching or listening later on when these are all released, then you can watch them one right after the other. But as I'm producing this here in late April of 2020 and releasing it immediately, it is just Part A, then that brings us up to where we are right now. Now, let me say a word about this lesson and why we're doing it, as we're going to think about the pattern and paradigm of prophecy. We're really going to lay a foundation in this lesson. This won't be a complete comprehensive study of biblical prophecy and all of its details, and that may be a project for another day. But we need to have some kind of a survey, some kind of an understanding of what the Bible teaches about the prophetic future before we can launch into looking at the coronavirus crisis in detail, because this is not what we would call newspaper exegesis, friends. We're not looking for headlines and then looking for a Bible passage that relates to them. We're studying the Bible in this series. We're using the coronavirus crisis to illustrate things that will happen in the future that the Bible talks about, and we want to gain wisdom from the Bible about what it says about those future events to help us in the present. So ultimately, our study is not of the coronavirus, but of the scriptures themselves. And so it's very important that we're all on the same page as we begin. And for those who may be listening or watching who are new to all these things, I want you to know where I'm coming from and what I am presenting. And again, this is a survey. It's not meant to be the final presentation on the things we're going to talk about in this lesson, but it hopefully will give us a basis for understanding the things that we're going to discuss as we go from here. The pattern and paradigm of prophecy. We understand, first of all, that God has a plan for history. He is moving history in a direction to ultimately bring glory to himself by accomplishing certain things that he has set in motion and that he has ordained to bring to pass. Ephesians 1 verse 11 says that he is working all things according to the counsel of his will. God has no other counselor but his own will. He has determined from eternity past the course of history, including things that are still in the future to our day that the Bible speaks about prophetically. God is the creator. Christ is Alpha and Omega. He is the creator of all things, and he sustains all things. And he began history in a garden at creation just a few thousand years ago in six literal days. That's young earth creation, which the Friends of Israel, I'm glad to say, adheres to, and which I adhere to. And he's moving history from that garden to a city in the eternal future. And the central event of all of history is the first coming of Christ and his death, burial, and resurrection on the cross. He comes to fulfill all that the scriptures had prophesied, and he comes as our Messiah and Savior, and he comes to present himself as the one who will return as King. He will return and establish his kingdom on the earth. The rule of man will give way to the rule of God and the millennial kingdom. The kingdom will come for 1,000 years as the entranceway to the eternal kingdom. And all of this, of course, comes from a literal understanding of the scriptures, which you see below. The Old Testament, or what our Jewish friends would call the Hebrew Bible, which is a great name for those books. And after the Hebrew Bible is completed, there is a time of silence, and then there is the revelation of the New Testament, which is given during and explains to us about the church age. So a very basic chart, but there may be some looking at this who are just new to all these things and need a basic understanding. By the way, these white background charts come from the CD version of the classic book, Charting the End Times by Tim LaHaye and Thomas Ice, and I'm grateful for using these charts that help us explain these events in history and in prophecy. Now, here's a little bit more detailed chart from my theological mentor, Dr. John Whitcomb. Dr. Whitcomb, along with Dr. Henry Morris, wrote the book The Genesis Flood back in 1961, and that book is credited as launching the modern biblical creation movement. And so Dr. Whitcomb, who went to be with the Lord just 2 months ago, is famous, among other things, for talking about the 5 worlds of history, science, and prophecy, which he put on this well-known chart that he created. The 5 worlds of history, science, and prophecy. In other words, what is the world, the scientific world, the physical world in which we live in terms of history and in terms of the prophetic future? And how does it change throughout that time? Well, the Bible actually talks about 5 different worlds. There was a very good world before the fall, the perfect paradise that God created and pronounced very good at the beginning. It lasted a very short time before Adam sinned and we had the fall and the curse. And we do not live in a perfect paradise today, do we, friends? Or if we did, we wouldn't have the coronavirus. But there was that perfect world originally, and after the curse, already there was a second world in just that short of a time. Peter speaks about that world, as you see on the chart. In 2 Peter 3:6, he calls it the world at that time, or as the New King James says, the world that then existed. It's the world, to quote Dr. Whitcomb's book title, by a sequel to the Genesis Flood, called the world that perished. The New King James, 2 Peter 3:6, the world that then existed perished, being flooded with water. So the world that existed between the curse and the flood is described for us within the early chapters of Genesis in chapters 4, where we have the murder by Cain of Abel. Chapter 5, which is really the graveyard chapter, it's the genealogy of those that follow after Adam, all the way down to the time of Noah, and it reminds us that this was a tremendous time that death reigned, the Bible says, Romans chapter 5. And we have chapter 6, we have, of course, the narrative beginning of the flood. Interesting, after the flood, what happens in Genesis chapter 9, that God refashions the world, and this would be the third world, the present heavens and earth, 2 Peter 3:7, the heavens and the earth which are now preserved. How does this world differ from the world before the flood? Well, God gives a number of commands and makes a number of statements with regard to that. In Genesis chapter 9, when Noah steps off the ark and all his family, in Genesis 9:2 says, the fear of you And the dread of you shall be on every beast on the earth, and on every bird of the air, and on all that move on the earth, and on all the fish of the sea. They are given into your hand. After the flood, God placed the fear of man on the animals. That implies that before the flood, that was not the case. Apparently, before the flood, the fear of the animals was on man. It was a dreadful, sin-cursed world, suffering the full immediate effects of the fall and the curse. And that curse was modified through the Genesis flood. God in grace establishes the present heavens and earth that we live in today. There are all kinds of scientific, of course, changes during that time of the flood that we see evidence of that all the way down to our time. But God modifies the curse, and he brings Noah and his family off of the ark onto a new world, if you will, a world in which he promises, Genesis 8:22, that while the earth remains, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, winter and summer, and day and night shall not cease. In other words, there would be a pattern, there would be regularity, stability to this world. May I say, the world that Noah stepped off of the ark onto, the third world, notice it lasts all the way to the second coming of Christ. We're still walking on the same earth that Noah walked on after he left the ark after the flood. Now, it was covered by water until that water receded. There was ultimately ice in some parts of the world until it melted. There are all kinds of geological events and issues that we won't go into here. And so certainly there are, you know, specific places of the world that have changed to some degree or other and undergone change throughout that time. My point is, it's the same overall world. Nothing has transformed that world since Noah's day to our day. It's the same world system. It's the same world of history and science. If wherever you are today, my address is Columbus, Wisconsin. If Noah had been here when he stepped off the ark, if he'd have walked where I'm sitting right now, it would be generally the same spot, the same dirt that I'm above right now. And so we live in that same world. As I said, it's God provided stability so that you could have a whole program of the nation of Israel in the Hebrew Bible, what we would call the Old Testament. You could have hundreds of years of a national program. You could build a nation on this world. You could have the ministry of Christ and his apostles and the subsequent ministry of the church through this whole church age in which the church is sent out to perform the task of the Great Commission, teaching and making disciples of the whole world, evangelizing and training people all through the nations of the world. You can do all of those things in this world. You can do them without fear of the world ending with something like global warming. God says, no, the earth is going to remain, and it's going to have those systematic, patterned events. Seed time and harvest, cold and heat, winter and summer, day and night shall not cease. Now, it may seem like there's an interruption to that right now with this coronavirus issue. Sometimes I struggle to know which day of the week of the month, which month of the year anymore we're in. But that, of course, is an exception, and hopefully a short-lived exception. The next world will be the thousand-year kingdom. Christ will come, and he will rule on the world for 1,000 years, and he will transform the world. He will make it like Genesis again, according to Matthew 19:28. He will reconstitute paradise worldwide for 1,000 years. that will be a different world than the world we live in now. That's a prophetic world, a scientific world, but a world of the prophetic future. And then finally, there's a new earth in eternity future. And so these are the five worlds. Now, that could be a whole study, a whole series in itself, but it's a broad overview. What is God doing in history? How do we begin to have an understanding of things that can give us a basis for looking at something like the coronavirus in light of Bible prophecy? That's what we're doing in this lesson. Now, if we want to get more specific and more detailed, we look at a chart like this. And don't be overwhelmed. We can't possibly consider everything on this chart here. And you can pause the video if you'd like and read and look up all the references, but we aren't going to take the time to go through all of that. It's just a chart of the seven dispensations of traditional dispensational theology. Now you say, dispensation. What on earth is a dispensation? Well, don't be overwhelmed by that either. It's actually a biblical word. Ephesians 1:10 talks about the dispensation of the fullness of the times. That would be the millennial kingdom. And Ephesians 3:2 talks about the dispensation of the grace of God. And then verse 5 of Ephesians 3 talks about other ages. So we know there's at least how many? Four dispensations at least, because we have the dispensation of the fullness of times, Ephesians 1:10, Ephesians 3:2, the dispensation of the grace of God, and verse 5, other ages, plural. There has to be at least four, and I believe there are seven total dispensations. Ephesians 3, verse 9 also talks about the fellowship of the mystery. Other Greek texts, those that are not the basis of the New King James, have there not the word fellowship, but the word dispensation. The word for fellowship is the word koinonia in New Testament Greek. The word for dispensation is oikonomia. And so it's very likely that those older manuscripts are correct and that someone simply wrote the wrong term because they sound alike, going from oikonomia to koinonia. So we have the dispensation of the mystery in Ephesians 3, verse 9. Oikonomia, if that word sounds a little familiar, it's because it's the basis of our English word economy. And it literally, the compound parts of the word literally mean the rules or the law of the house. What are the rules of the house? What is the law of the house? What is the law of the land, we might say? Dr. Reynolds Showers, longtime Bible teacher for the Friends of Israel, in his wonderful book, There Really Is a Difference, said the different dispensations are different ways of God's administering his rule over the world. That's a wonderful, concise definition of a dispensation. Notice they are not different ways of salvation. Salvation has always been by grace alone, through faith alone, based in the finished work of Christ alone. No one has ever been saved by law keeping or by works or by anything else. And he is sure to make that clear, and I want to make that clear. But he says a dispensation is not an age of history. It's not that it's a time period. It may cover a time period, and it does cover time periods, in fact, but that's not the primary point or purpose or definition. It's the rule of God in which he gives man new rules of the house, if you will. New revelation is provided. And so we have a dispensation of innocence before the fall. And then, of course, there is a great change at the fall and the curse. And we have a dispensation of conscience. And then after the flood, we have the institution of human government. And then after the Tower of Babel, we have the call of Avram, and the dispensation of promise. A promise is given to him. A covenant is made with Abraham. And we have the establishment of God's people, Israel, the nation of Israel. And that nation really becomes a theocratic kingdom at Mount Sinai and the giving of the law. Great new revelation is given to them. And then we have at the day of Pentecost, the launch of the church age. I like to say not the dispensation of grace, although that is a biblical term in Ephesians 3, but I really like to call it the dispensation of the church, because that's really outwardly what this dispensation is about. When we say dispensation of grace, some misunderstand that and misuse it and say, we are now saved by grace, whereas previously men were saved by keeping the law. That is not what we mean when we say dispensation of grace. The only way ever to be saved was by grace. The difference is not salvation by grace during this dispensation, but rather the ability to live by grace. Romans 6:14, sin shall not have dominion over you, for you are not under law, but under grace. And so living by grace and sanctification and obedience by the grace of God revealed in the New Testament. That's a distinguishing feature of the church age, and that could be a whole subject in itself. But we want to keep this lesson brief, and so we'll move ahead quickly and say that the church began on the day of Pentecost. It ends with the day of Christ at the rapture of the church. Then there is a 7-year tribulation period in which God returns to work in and through the nation of Israel. He's bringing the people of Israel during those 7 years of tribulation, the time of Jacob's trouble, the 70th week of Daniel. He's bringing the people of Israel to repentance and to receive by faith their king and his kingdom, the Messiah, Jesus Christ. And then Christ rules in Jerusalem for 1,000 years in his millennial kingdom. And then we have the final judgment and eternity future. These are dispensations. This is the outline of understanding all of the Bible and all of history in terms of biblical revelation as it's interpreted literally, that is, at face value in its context according to normal grammar and an understanding of biblical history. And as we seek to put those things together in context according to the words that God has revealed by inspiration, and we take them at their face meaning, I believe we get this understanding of history. It's not something we're imposing on the Bible, it's something we're drawing out of the Bible. All right, biblical dispensations, traditional dispensational theology. All right. Now, what are the big, big picture items in all of this? You see them here on the chart. Israel, promise and law, and the church. Well, where did Israel come from? God created the nation of Israel. He speaks this way in Isaiah chapter 43, talking about forming Israel, verse 1, redeeming them. The fact that, verse 7, he has created Israel for his own glory and formed him and made him. And verse 15 of this chapter, 43 of Isaiah, I am the Lord your Holy One, the creator of Israel, your King. How did he create the nation of Israel? Well, originally through calling one man, Avram, and making a covenant with him, telling him that he would make him a great nation and bless him, make his name great, that he would be a blessing, and that he would bless those who bless him, curse those who curse him. For in Avram, all the families of the earth, all the nations of the earth would be blessed. God promises him a nation. God promises to give him a seed, a posterity. God promises to make him a blessing. Indeed, a blessing to the entire world. And this covenant is the basis for understanding all that God will do in the nation of Israel. It's repeated over and over again to Abram, who becomes Abraham, and to Isaac and to Jacob, throughout the book of Genesis and the Pentateuch and the Old Testament, and even in the New Testament. It's the basis for understanding all that God would do in the nation of Israel and even in all the earth from the time it was given forward. It is of monumental, fundamental importance, the Abrahamic covenant. So we'll begin there and pick up and go forward next time when we join together again to study further regarding prophetic lessons from the coronavirus crisis. This is Paul Sharp for the Friends of Israel. I pray that you'll receive and enjoy and give thanks for every blessing that comes to you from God this day. Thank you for joining me.